Hello and welcome. We are in the middle of a pandemic. India is about to report 91 lakh coronavirus cases. We're seeing over 500 deaths a day due to coronavirus complications. Cities like Delhi, the national capital, are reporting a crisis of a shortage of ventilators. Students have lost a year of their education. Yet, at least five Indian states have decided that one of their top priorities is to pass a law based on a Hindutva conspiracy theory aimed at preventing interfaith marriages. At least five BJP-led states have spoken about bringing in laws aimed at curbing the alleged trend of love jihad. And I use this term in quotes because this term doesn't exist in Indian law so far. In fact, no term of love jihad has been reported by any central agency. It is a term cited first by BJP leaders, which then gets picked up by the media and then gets a life of its own on social media. But it's basically a conspiracy theory involving the conversion of Hindu women to Islam under the garb of love and marriage. So is this the reality, as some of our politicians would like us to believe? Or is there an alternative narrative too of interfaith marriages in India? Let's try and bring you the other side. On We the People tonight, let's try challenge this bigotry. We have on the show couples taking on hate. Let's go across first to we have Sadaf Chaudhary and Yatin Grover joining us. We'll also have Jonathan Koshi and his wife, Trisha, who will join us too. We have a few of them. Let's start with Yatin. Yatin and Sadaf, you were work colleagues. You then had an office romance. On an Instagram post, Sadaf, you described it as a 21st century rom-com. And you say, except that Yatin is a Punjabi Hindu from Gurgaon, I'm a Sunni Muslim from Lucknow, and the road to a happily ever after was far from rosy, you say. Tell us about that.
So yes, that is how it is. And we were working together in the same office, and it never struck our minds that, you know, in today's time and age, we'll be facing so much resistance when we decide to get married. And a lot of hue and cry ensued when we told our respective families. And the mandate given to both of us individually was, I was told, never marry a Hindu, you know, marry whoever, do not marry a Hindu. Yatin was given the mandate, bring any girl possible, do not bring home a Muslim girl, you know, and we both flouted that. So, yes, it took a lot of convincing, about, say, a year or so, before some of our family members eventually very reluctantly consented, and we registered, we got married under the Special Marriage Act without converting and without... Yeah, and after allaying all their thoughts and fears that either of us would convert to the other faith, which did not happen.
So and then you go on to say in your post that 3 years on, we couldn't be more integrated.
Right.
What is that about?
So I think Sadaf has already explained in the post that, you know, we've been celebrating everything. So before we got married, I think we only used to celebrate our side of festivals, but after we got married, I think it just got really beautiful because we've been celebrating all the festivals. Every month we have been celebrating something or the other in our family. I think it's really beautiful what has happened, and the families have really they're loving it. You know what we share now. You know what they share with each other.
Yeah, although my family has gotten exposed to Holi and Diwali and Gurpurab. Whereas Yatin's family, they've never experienced semai and biryani, you know. So just a mix of both sides, both cultures. It's quite beautiful, actually.
Well, perhaps it's this integration, this beautiful integration that certain sections of our society actually object to, because the more you keep people apart, the more you say certain buildings you can't, only certain communities can live there, only certain types of food, you treat, certain communities like the other. But Yatin, the truth is, as you point out, that most people do want their kids to marry within the community because, as they'd say, you know, already marriage is so hard.
Right.
So you heard that also from your parents?
Yes. So like Sadaf mentioned, it was my mother who had, you know, jokingly said a long time ago that, you know, okay, whatever, you marry whoever, but don't marry a Muslim girl because we don't understand their culture and it'll be difficult for us to adjust and for the girl also to adjust. So don't do that.
No, so but this was before you were dating. So this is before you met Sadaf.
Yes.
She had any clue that you were seeing somebody who's
It was right after the school, I think. It was long back, you know, when I was in college maybe. So we started dating when we were working together. So this particular thing happened a long time ago. It was a joke, basically, but then it stuck, you know, with me. And eventually I ended up flouting that particular request that was made by my mother. But then after when I had mentioned it, there was a complete silence in the house for a good 6 months. And then they had again asked me that, are you still with Sadaf? I was like, yes, I'm stronger than ever. I'm with her only. So that's when they were like, okay, we can consider it because we can't just keep, you know, you also waiting or suffering like that. So let's just meet Sadaf's parents, and that's how, you know, things moved forward. So,
well, that's an interesting thought because despite your mom saying something like this to you, even though you weren't involved or dating anyone who was from the Muslim community, you didn't let it affect your psyche. I'll go across to Jonathan Koshi and Trisha Lalchandani, both of whom work with students, and ask you about that a little bit later. But first, Jonathan and Trisha, you're both a PhD research scholars studying in Paris. Tell us about how you guys got together and what are your concerns about these so-called love jihad laws? Because if passed, they'll be applicable to all religions, not just to Hindu-Muslim couples.
Hi, Sarah, for having us over. Certainly a matter of concern for all of us at this moment. Not surprising considering what we've been observing in this country for the last couple of years. Trisha and I met and we fell in love and we decided that we needed to be together. And we spoke to our parents about it and they were okay with it, you know. We really didn't have a lot of drama about it. It was quite a smooth affair because we had an intelligent conversation about this whole thing. Told our parents that we are from different cultures, but it's okay, you know. We know each other for some time and that we are okay about living together. So I think that's why we went ahead, and it's been fine so far. It's been good.
And you've had, I can see you had both a Hindu wedding and a Malayali Kerala wedding.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, because I think one of the ways in which we understood marriage was, you know, we weren't getting married because we had to live together in order to legitimize our love. I think that was fine. You know, we saw marriage as an institution where people we cared about could come together and celebrate that occasion. And I thought that the only way we could do that was by acknowledging the different rituals and schemes and traditions from which we came. And I saw those two occasions as an opportunity for people from two different communities to come and get to know each other.
Which perhaps doesn't happen often enough. Trisha, you and Jonathan both work with students, right? How do you see everything that's going on around us? Jonathan has alluded to this. How does this affect their psyche?
When we started out, we were young, right? We were students. And we did not, I don't think we acknowledged the fact that we belonged to different religions. We met as individuals. We liked each other for what we were. And I think that's important that you acknowledge the individual for who they are, outside of the labels that are ascribed to them. So when we are interacting with students, that's what we try to do. We try to, inculcate in them the value, the values of acceptance, of treating people as people rather than as, as individuals who come with labels of identity and so on. So that's what we try to do.
Okay. Asif Iqbal now joins us. Asif Iqbal and Ranu are founders of Dhanak. It's a support group for couples like them in India. I want to first ask you, what kind of support when you are reached out to, what are the fears of those who call for help on your helplines? What are the biggest misconceptions out there when it comes to interfaith marriages?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for calling us and giving this opportunity.
Of course.
You know, first I would like to tell this organization is working with the issue of honor crime, forced marriage and right to choose. It is not only working on with the couples with interfaith background.
Sure.
So having said so, now coming to your question, generally the question that the couple is approaching us with, they are more concerned about how they will be safe, how they will solemnize their marriage and how their parents will be safe in this scenario. So they generally approach us, they want help in their marriage. And in most of the cases, they want their family to come along. They want their help and they should be open for the marriage. So they seek help in this direction.
So you often have to counsel parents also?
We do that, but it is not very, very helpful because once parents make up their mind, it is very difficult to convince them. Mm. But yes, we do that when the marriage takes place and the couple is with us. So then the reconciliation process is helpful and they're open for that.
Mm. So, you know, Sadaf and Yatin had a special marriage act. The chief ministers of these five BJP states, some of whom are going in for elections, interestingly, they're so worked up about people converting for the sake of marriage. Is there enough awareness that there is already in Indian law a system that allows for interfaith marriages where you don't have to convert, where you have the Special Marriage Act, where you're not needed to convert at all in order to marry?
Is this question to me?
Yeah. Asif.
Yeah, of course, there is an act which allows, you know, irrespective of faith, anybody can, even two people of same faith can use this act for the marriage. But the problem with the, even people are aware, they know it by the name of court marriage. So, which generally happens when they go to the court and advocate, solemnize their marriage as per the religious ritual and exchange the affidavits. And generally people consider it as a court marriage. The process is, although the act is very good, but there are certain issues which are very, very, you know, deterrent and very, very challenging for anybody using it. You need witnesses, you need 30 days notice period, and the practices which are related to, you know, finding out, sending police to the house, publication in the newspaper, they are so much dangerous that nobody would, you know, prefer to go choose for that. Even the advocate suggests, why don't you go religious marriage, do a religious marriage and then, you know, we will exchange the affidavit or get a certificate, that is enough. So, I mean, that's the biggest challenge.
Ranu, let me ask you, you know, this, you're a Hindu woman marrying outside your community. The bogey here often by people who are pushing this, you know, trope about love jihad is that the Hindu woman or the woman here doesn't know their own mind. How does that make you feel?
I personally, it is a very perturbed scenario because at one, there are times when we talk about empowering women, we are talking about women need to be assertive, they need to get educated, they need to work, they are going out. And suddenly when it comes to making a decision, they are even voting. And they have a contribution, they have a right to select the government. But when it comes to choosing their own life partner, suddenly everybody feels that the woman is so not capable of taking a decision. And her whole ability to assert, to decide for herself is challenged. Not only by the parents. At times, we have seen that families still, they do question out of concern, and also because still they, people with interfaith marriages do not come out so much that it is a very, you know, normalized thing, or it is not very mainstream. So parents have their apprehension. The challenge comes when these groups from outside start creating a propaganda around it. So that's what my take is.
And the young couples want to protect their parents too, which is why they often come to you asking how they can protect their parents from these groups. But what happens if, you know, these threats or these promises that these states are making actually comes into play? Let's bring in Karuna Nandi here. She's an advocate at the Supreme Court. So, Karuna, these states claim that they're only opposing religious conversion by force under the guise of marriage. But in the process, will we then, or are we emboldening the role of the police, of inquiries, police coming to your home, of families' ability to then annul marriages against the wishes of the couple themselves?
There are two problems here, Sarah. One is that the law will make the process itself very punishing. Already there is a lacuna in the law under the Special Marriage Act, which actually Dhanak has challenged before the Delhi High Court, and the Delhi High Court has said that they are going to examine it. And the lacuna is this, is that there is a process by which you a notice has to be put up and objections are actually invited with regard to marriage under the Special Marriage Act, which is not the case under marriages under personal law, right? So I have had, clients say that, come to me and say that, look, I am really worried that, particularly when it's a Hindu woman and a Muslim man, that some kind of rowdies that will actually be protected by the state in the current scenario are going to not only make official objections, but are going to come and, be rowdy and beat me up and beat up my family. And these are not, in the current scenario, very remote possibilities. So that publicity aspect has been challenged before the High Court by Dhanak, and I'm sure, they'll tell us more about this. And the court will examine the constitutionality of that, because, of course, now under Puttaswamy, the privacy judgment, there is a right to intimate decision-making. There is a right to who you have a relationship with, whether it is a man or a woman, a person of the opposite gender, whether it's a transgender person, or whether it's somebody from a different state. Now, we see increasingly that where it's a question of people from the same gender marrying, or not marrying, rather, although there's an interesting Madras High Court judgment that says that if you are a trans woman, you can marry a cis man, thereby legalizing certain types of marriage that weren't legal before. But anyway, we see situations where two lesbians run away, where two gay men run away and want to live together, that we see instances of courts now protecting them. And that is really what we need to see if we're going to abide by the privacy judgment, if we're going to abide by the Article 21, the right to choice in our life partners, whether it's to abide by Article 25, the right to choose one's religion, right? The thing is that with this environment, what's happening with five states now saying that they're going to pass these so-called love jihad laws, and the proof of the pudding is in the eating, we have to see what the laws are, the bills actually say. But what they're threatening to do publicly, officials of the state ministers, they're saying that they're going to make so-called love jihad, and we don't know what the definition is going to be. And also, there's no data. Mostly, yeah. City must doesn't exist, right? They're going to make it a cognizable and non-bailable offense. Now, this, I think, is a huge, huge problem, because it means that your constable on the street can make their own decision, can arrest the person, does not have to release them on bail, and then only the judge can release them and can put whatever conditions there are. And only at the end of the trial, like, does the process end. So what's happening there is that the process will become punishment if these laws pass. Mm. Any constitutional challenge will take time.
Yes.
And also we see the courts, some courts, flowing away from the individual liberties, I feel, in my opinion, enshrined in the Constitution.
Mm.
We also see a normative effect, which is that when a law is passed, a message goes out that this is the way society is meant to act, and groups that are sort of offshoots of the BJP and other groups, get energy from that.
Correct.
And the lumpen elements then get energy from that, and then sometimes the police will think that they need to protect them as opposed to the people exercising the individual.
That's right. So, Asif, Iqbal, you work with this issue on the ground, with cases of couples coming to you for help, for support. What are your worries about what could happen? What are your concerns in case such a law is brought in, or in this case, five laws in these five states?
The concern has already started, because what we are watching and observing now, that even police officer or an ADM is openly stating that you tum log to love jihad karwana. And the parents who were earlier, as one of the couples was stating in this, that, you know, they were concerned that you should not get married to a Muslim or to a Hindu because of, you know, social reasons or what. Now they are saying, okay, now if you do that, you know what is happening. I will call RSS, I will call BHP, I will call Jamaat. So this is what is happening, and couples are being threatened by the parents and the executives. So, I mean, this has already started.
Right, yeah, dangerous. And so Sadaf and Yatin, you're both lawyers, right? I think we've lost the line with them. Asif, you can answer this question till we try and get them back on. All of our panelists, unfortunately, all the couples joining us today are educated. They're aware of their rights. Two of them are lawyers. Two of them are professors. What about young couples who are not from the same socioeconomic background, not as educated, who maybe don't know what their rights are?
I will give you one simple example. Right now, we are handling a case from Rajasthan. And the couple, because they cannot solemnize their marriage as per the Special Marriage Act from that particular state, because the processes are so difficult and regressive, they cannot even perform a religious marriage, which the couples used to do earlier. So they have left that state, and now they are here in Delhi. The problem is that now they have to wait for another 1 month for the jurisdiction under Section 5 of the Special Marriage Act to prove their jurisdiction. And then the notice period. So the entire period is going to take 2.5 months for that.
Loss of job.
Loss of job is there. And the couple is already in the fear that if an FIR is lodged, they will be taken back. There will be a legal action on them. So this what actually which was happening, which was even not correct. People used to go for a religious marriage and somehow it was acceptable. Now they are being looked with a doubt from everybody. Even whenever an interfaith couple will come and say that this is an interfaith couple, everybody will see them with a doubt, and there will be some kind of fear which will exist everywhere.
So the odds become insurmountable, more than they were in the past.
Yes, it has increased.
Trisha, you know, I asked Ranu this, and, you know, maybe you can also respond over here again as a Hindu woman who's married outside of her community. The trope here really is that this is a countrywide plot. It's Muslim men, or there's a man who's trying to dupe this unsuspecting Hindu woman into marriage. The aim is actually to convert them. And so it seems that people can't somehow believe that a Hindu woman can voluntarily elope or convert or fall in love. They're so naive, they're so impressionable, you can't know your own mind. But all this is being done for your security.
It's not just a question of the Hindu woman, it's really just any woman. I think that was something that was happening in our case also. It was not very explicitly stated, but I definitely did experience it. From the conversations that I had with my parents, I felt like more than the fact that I was going to a different culture, that I was going to be in a space that they were not familiar with, or that I was not familiar with, there was the concern that whether or not I had made the right decision, whether or not I was, it was, I think to some extent it might have been difficult for them to accept that I had made the decision all by myself, a big decision like that. So it really is about being in denial of the capability of a woman to take her own decisions. That it really quite often boils down to that.
All right. So, Sadaf and Yatin, we lost you earlier, but let me just try and ask you as we wind up, come to a close on the show, why have you chosen to speak out?
You will not believe, there are several people who are constantly DMing me, a lot of youngsters who write to me, who are in the same situation, who have probably gotten to know my story because it was put out on some platform. And when you see these, you know, people in their early 20s trying to struggle with, you know, A, coming to terms with the fact that they're in love with someone from another culture, B, trying to get their parents on board, and C, trying to fight the society, it just gets extremely daunting for them. For us, I think it was easier. We've had the privilege to have had an exposure to an urban life, and to have been lawyers per se, to be comfortable with how courts work, how the offices of the courts are, the registrar, the SDM. So we had knowledge about all these things, which made us getting married under the... The same could not be said for a lot of other people. You know, going to court for them is a daunting experience. So unless we make a special marriage, a marriage under Special Marriage Act, as easy as a Grahak Jago campaign, you know, where everyone knows their rights and remedies, you know, we really are making an empowering act a deterrent.
Yeah, true.
So, which is why it's important to put out stories like ours to tell people that, you know, you've got this, never give in.
To normalize this, just as there's an attempt to normalize the so-called, the use of the term love jihad, we also need to normalize your realities, your stories. This is also India, this also exists. Interfaith marriages exist. Communal conflicts also exist, but what we choose to celebrate is what defines us. Thank you all for joining us on We the People tonight. Thank you. Bye-bye.